On this episode of The Big Number, we dive into the stats to answer these questions. Jay-Z put how much money on OKC to win in five? And the Pacers offense, how are they doing this offensively and defensively? And lastly, Kevin Durant, what is our favorite trade destination for the Phoenix Suns forward? All that coming up right after this. Welcome, welcome, welcome. I'm Tom Haberstroh. Welcome to The Big Number. We do this every week here at Yahoo Sports with my man, Dan Devine. Dan, what's going on, man?
Tom, I'm coming to you live from a cavernous hotel room in downtown Indianapolis, Indiana, the site of the 2025 NBA Finals, which has not gone the way everybody predicted, Tom Haberstroh. So I have a feeling we're going to be talking about that a fair amount today. So why don't you hit me with it? I'm ready to put up some numbers. What is this week's big number, Tom?
Yeah, this week's big number is $1 million, as in $1 million. Jay-Z placed a $1 million bet at a sports book this week for OKC to win in exactly five games. And he lost that bet because of what happened on Wednesday night. So $1 million that Jay-Z has lost, that is the big number. I didn't see a big number crossover into hip hop, but here we are in the NBA Finals talking about the Indiana Pacers. And so we got to lead with this amazing story courtesy of Yahoo Sports' betting guru, Ben Fox, who alerted me to this. He posted on X, and I was like, wait, is this a real story? I had to check this, Dan. Did you know about this before I alerted you to it?
I did not. I feel like I've been too in the actual games bubble, so I did not know this. So hit me with it. Tell me more about it.
Yeah, so he had a plus 230 bet. So basically, he put down $1 million to make $3.3 million. And you might say to yourself, wait, that seems like a lot of money on the payout based on the fact that everyone has been picking OKC in five, including yours truly. I pick OKC in five, and he was going to get $3.3 million if it hit. And obviously, after the Pacers just blasted OKC in game three, that's off the board. So he just lost $1 million. This is now in a betting world. We now have these news stories where Jay-Z has put down $1 million, and Fanatics, the sports book, they posted this before the finals. This was like an ad. It was like, hey, we're promoting that Jay-Z just put down $1 million on this very precise bet, and now he's out $1 million. So I don't know. Jay-Z, I got a seven-figure bet, and unfortunately, because Benedict Mathurin scored points like Michael Jordan, he's not a winner, ain't one. How was that? Pretty good?
Did that sound like Jay-Z?
You
sound exactly like Jay-Z. I think everybody can agree on that. My first thought was, yeah, he loses $1 million, but like, I don't know if you remember, like the Nets could go over 82 and he'd look at you like the gravy. So like he's not in a position where even if the sports book finds him, it's, you know, what's that to a mofo like him? So I think, you know, Jay-Z's probably going to be okay. Although the idea of our advertisement for this service is someone losing $1 million doesn't feel great, but maybe we should just skip past that and move past that quickly.
You got to get that TJ McConnell off the court or else I'm going to lose my $1 million bet. Is that good?
Well, he's got 99 problems and one of them is Pacers 2-1. You know, there's that one. We got that.
We doing big topping, dunking with ease. Big topping on HEADs.
My goodness.
We doing big topping up in OKC. It's just that Hallie man, Rick C, and Spicy P.
Oh, how about that? That was, you see, because you went past the initial, you went to the second line of it. I love that for us. Yeah. What, Tom, what is it that the
Rick
Pacers...
Rick C. Can we just start Rick C. as just his name now?
Ooh. I mean, R.I.P. or to Pimp C. the legend, you know, Underground Kings. Rick Carlisle, an Underground King to some degree in the way that he's getting his respect for coaching. Like, he's been not new to this. He's true to this. He's been here for years. That was one of the things that this series is what made me think about is allow me to reintroduce myself. My name is Rick. I've been doing this. I am this dude when it comes to being able to find a way. Your team might be better than mine for a 100-game sample, but I can make mine better than yours four times once. That's it. That's all I need to do.
This is amazing. This is amazing. I just want to apologize to the listeners out there.
Apologize to them. They deserve what they get for listening to this podcast. What do the Pacers do as effectively as any team in the league, Tom Haberstroh?
They play defense.
Close.
They play offense. They're in the NBA Finals. They're really good. What's the answer here?
They run this town featuring Rihanna. So, listen, everybody gets to be as upset about this as they want, but we are doing these shows from far-flung locations on no sleep, and we're coming up with jokes and puns as much as we can to try to make fun of the fact, I guess, that Jay-Z lost $1 million.
People might say we should follow a bunch of different podcasts, but I would like to say that this is the blueprint. Like, this is it.
Look at that.
You don't do better podcasting than what we're doing right now.
And I mean, well, I think that's absolutely right. And the one thing that I know for sure about the Pacers is that you can't knock their hustle. So there's just, yeah. I mean, is that enough now? Have we got enough of them down?
I think so. I don't want to like continue the podcast and have our listeners
Jay-Z
pun?
Sorry, one more. What did TJ McConnell say to the Oklahoma City Thunder throughout the second quarter?
What?
Give it to me. Give me that funk, that nasty, that inbounds pass. Oh, God.
Oh, that's great.
The retention rate's going to be absolutely plummeting. This is going to be incredible. They're going to hear 1 million, then they're going to start hearing this, and this is going to go out. Anyway, all right. We've had our fun.
The show's over. I think we can end it right there.
Thank you so much.
I'm happy with this.
Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe.
Thanks to our producers.
Yes, right, exactly.
God, that was so good. It's so bad that it's so good. And that's what we're here for. Dan and I are here to provide you with an inordinate amount of big puns. That's a very different hip hop artist. Big number puns. I just think when we're talking about this series, we have to loop it into Jay-Z somehow. But we're going to actually do some hardcore analysis here. Not hard knock. Hardcore analysis. We're gonna actually talk about this series here because I think what the Pacers have done is this amazing like bait and switch where they're almost stealing OKC's superpower. They've like kind of taken like Raiden's little electrocution thing and just like taken it and then thrown it right back at OKC. Because it's like when you look at how they've played, they are so good now, their defense, in turning you over and then converting it. The TJ McConnell of stealing it out of bounds and then converting it on the other end. What he was doing in this game was like when he stole it from Alex Caruso himself and laid it in. Do you think Alex Caruso in his head was like, just damn, that was nice. Like, I'm not even going to contest this. He did contest it, but part of me was wondering if Alex Caruso was just so jealous of TJ McConnell in this game that he just he was beside himself.
I think there's, if nothing else, a game-recognized game component to it for sure. Like, this is like Alex Caruso goes bananas in game two, tilts that game, you know, along with Aaron Wiggins, their role players, their reserves, tilt that game towards Oklahoma City. And then in game three, TJ McConnell, Obi Toppin, as you mentioned, and Benedict Mathurin, obviously, game of his life coming off the bench. Like, they return the favor. And there's, you know, it's, I'm sure there is, like, there has been real studied analysis of why, oh, you know, do role players actually play better at home, or is that just like an old canard? But damn if it doesn't feel like it keeps coming true. And the fact that you got that kind of production, I think it was the total wound up being 48-19 in bench scoring in game three. It was a monster swing factor for Indiana. And yeah, I mean, to your point, coming into the series, so much of the discussion of these, you know, pros versus cons, this, you know, the counter matches, all those sorts of things, was Indiana's offense versus Oklahoma City's defense. I know I wrote about that. I know that there have been, you know, over the course of the series, we've talked about different adjustments that have been made and things like that. And I think that tended to overlook the Indiana Pacers defense and what impact that could have on the Oklahoma City offense. And like, I think we're seeing it. I think to your point, all year long, Oklahoma City's superpower was we are the highest volume turnover generators in the entire NBA. We use that to fuel our transition offense. We use that to maybe, you know, like support or buttress the fact that our half court offense can get a little gummy sometimes. And the Pacers, in a series where their half court offense has gotten a little gummy sometimes, were able to completely flip that switch on Oklahoma City in game three. And it's left the Thunder on really sort of tenuous, uncomfortable ground heading into a game four that's got to be, at this point, like, it's their season. They got to win game four because we haven't seen the Pacers lose consecutive games since, I think, early March or maybe like something like that. So needing to go three straight with a team that's playing this confidently and has a formula and a system that's working for them this well, that will be an awfully tall task, even for a team that's been as good all year long as this Thunder team has.
Here's a crazy stat. In this series, Oklahoma City is scoring 0.83 points off of their steals, like on average.
Wow.
An 83 offensive rating.
That's brutal.
In this series. So what that translates to is that Indiana is turning the ball over here and there, but they're able to limit the bleeding. Like, they're able to stop that. And on the other end, like you saw in game three, Indiana scored 17 points off their 13 steals, and the Thunder scored just 7 points off their steals.
Wow.
They've got this like black magic, some like voodoo way of stopping OKC when they turn the ball over. These are live ball turnovers. These are live ball turnovers that in the regular season, OKC, or even before the even before this series, postseason, OKC was scoring 136 points per 100 possessions, 136 offensive rating off of those live ball turnovers, those steals. And now it's just 83. And so when they were scoring like 14 points per game off of just steals alone, now that's at 8 in this series. And so they've lost almost half of that potency in the open court, turning the ball over and turning you over and then scoring the other way. That was such a demoralizing factor for OKC that they could go on these runs, and Indiana has stopped it. And not only that, they've thrown it right back at them. They had 0 points off of turnovers in game one. This is so crazy. Indiana didn't score a single point off of a steal in game one, and they had 17 in game three. Completely changed how they are playing in this series. And they won game one. They didn't even need that to win in game one. And now they're doing it totally differently. They were like, yeah, let's like try to be OKC and see how it goes. And then they beat them on their home floor. So I just, they are changing their forms. Like they're like this amoeba that is able to just change form on the fly. And you got Benedict Mathurin just looking like I said, in that really terrible Jay-Z lyric, those not bars, I'm not going to call them bars, that he looked like Michael Jordan out there. Like, he was so good in game three off the bench. And TJ McConnell was incredible with his 5 steals. His stat line had never been done in the NBA finals coming off the bench. And it's just, what a story of resiliency, a story of this continuity that we, you know, in today's transaction league, the Pacers are just, they will not go away, and they're going to continue to bring their force. What a performance in game three. What a performance in these finals.
Like, a truly wild context to be put in. Like, Benedict Mathurin, the only players since 2000 who have scored 25 or more in a finals game at his age. He's 22 years old. So, like, that young, that many points in the finals. Kobe, Tony Parker, LeBron, Kawhi, Benedict Mathurin. Come on. Like, that's unbelievable. And asked Pascal Siakam about him last night, or we were talking to him after the game, and he said, like, when he's aggressive like that, like, he makes it it looks easy for him out there. And that's, you know, you look at the Thunder are so often able to impose their physicality, their athleticism, the advantages that they've got on the wing onto opposing ball handlers and creators. Benedict Mathurin can stand, you know, eye to eye, shoulder to shoulder, physicality to physicality with all those dudes. Like, he is not going to get bullied around, even against Lou Dort, even against Alex Caruso. He's going to be able to, when he turns the corner, lowers his shoulder, he's going to get where he wants to go. He's going to be able to continue to finish through that traffic. So the sheer, I mean, sometimes the bench performance can be volatile, but I think that's the beauty part of Indiana. It's what Tyrese Haliburton said after the game last night. Like, the great thing about having depth like ours is you never know whose night it's going to be. But with so many guys that they feel confident in turning to, you got a pretty good idea that it's going to be somebody's night. And that is my kind of half-baked, still formulating take here is, as much as Tyrese Haliburton can come in for criticism for, you know, being insufficiently aggressive at times, or sometimes receding to the background of the offense, or not generating enough shots for himself, those sorts of things, which, by the way, not a problem last night. You know, definitely more aggressive scoring game for him in game three. But I wonder if his willingness to do that, to sometimes subside and move back, empowers these other guys, gives them more room to step to the front of the stage and into the spotlight, makes them feel confident that if they've got it going, they're going to keep getting fed. It's not like I'm only going to get two looks here, so I got to cash them out. And if I don't, I might be going sitting on the bench for the next 30 minutes. Like, the overwhelming, you know, Rick Carlisle keeps calling it the ecosystem of the Pacers is, whoever's got it going, we're going to them. And we're going to give everybody a chance to get going. It was Benedict Mathurin. It was TJ McConnell. It was Obi Toppin in game three. And as a result of that, we're halfway to the Indiana Pacers winning the NBA championship. I cannot believe it's true, but here we are.
Here we are. And Mathurin, the way he plays, it reminds me a lot of Jordan Poole on that championship Warriors team, where it was like, we don't know exactly what we're going to get every single night, but he is going to win us a game or two when it matters most. And with that pass-heavy offense that the Warriors love to do under Steve Kerr, with Steph Curry and with Draymond and Klay Thompson, it was like, we just got this wild card in Jordan Poole that can get you a bucket on a moment's notice. And he's built for that. Same thing with Benedict Mathurin. I just think he's been kind of that X factor for them in ways that you need in the NBA Finals. So here we are, two games away from crowning the Indiana Pacers, yes, sirs, the NBA champions against a 68-win OKC team that I picked in five. Jay-Z picked in five. Dan, what did you pick in this series?
I picked Thunder in six. So technically, I'm still on the board, but I have not placed any wagers on a specific specific outcome here. So, at this point, I think it's pretty safe to say that I'm in danger, too, on that prediction.
That's right. That's right. The Pacers are making everybody look stupid right now for betting against them. Damn, we're going to do four little numbers after the break. How the Pacers have fooled people like Jay-Z and myself for thinking that this would be over in five in OKC's favor. We're going to talk more about how the Indiana Pacers are up 2-1 against OKC in the NBA Finals right after this. Apologies to Jay-Z for butchering your lyrics. One of the greatest
Absolutely. Ever.
Hovestro? Tom Hovestro?
Ooh, does that work? I like that. I like that more than I should.
Don't. You don't.
I do.
I don't even like it.
Well, I'm going to like
it.
I'm going to like it enough for the both of us.
Okay. We got four little numbers about the Indiana Pacers and what they've done this postseason, especially here in the NBA Finals. How they're up 2-1. Dan, what's the first little number?
First little number is 10 and 15. So I know that's two little numbers, but bear with me. 10 and 15 was the Indiana Pacers' record after a four-point loss to the Charlotte Hornets on December 8th, 2024. A night on which both Tyrese Haliburton and Pascal Siakam scored in single digits, and it took a 30-point game from TJ McConnell off the bench just to stay close to the Charlotte Hornets. The reality, as we've talked about, is that Indiana struggled early in this season because of a bunch of injuries, right? Aaron Nesmith went out, Andrew Nembhard went out, Ben Shepherd went out. They lost both their backup centers in the first week of the season to Achilles ruptures. They were just absolutely decimated by injuries for the first, 30% of the season. And so I think here, Tom, you're familiar with you're smarter than me. So I'm guessing you are familiar with the idea of anchoring bias or the anchoring effect. The idea that when you learn one thing, you rely super heavily on that piece of information, even if new information comes in.
Make a good first impression. That's right.
There you go. Because that's what people are going to remember, is that first impression. So I think there's a decent chance that the reason that people like Jay-Z might have been willing to pony up an awful lot of money to because they didn't like the chances of the Indiana Pacers is because they remembered hearing, well, they got to the Eastern Conference Finals, but that was kind of fluky. There were all those injuries. And then they checked in on them at the beginning of the season and saw that they were 10-15 and Halliburton didn't even make the All-Star team. And they were like, they're not that good. Like they've been getting hot. They've been getting lucky. And so nobody updated their priors when Indiana started becoming an unbelievably good team from like December 9th on. I think since that 10-15 start, they're 54-22. They went 12-4 against the East. They're now 2-1 against the best team in the West. Maybe it's time now to update some of those priors.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, that 10-15 start, it's not only anchoring bias, but there's another one is confirmation bias, right? The other logical fallacy is like, if you didn't believe that they were legit in that postseason run last year, getting to the Eastern Conference Finals, hey, 10-15, this team's like eight games out of 500. And that's not the right math. It's actually five, but whatever. Yeah. You get the point. You look at this and you say, Exhibit A, the Indiana Pacers, that was a fluke last year, getting to the Eastern Conference Finals. And if they get the same injury luck as everybody else did in the Eastern Conference last year in the postseason, yeah, they're going to get exposed. But I think what's interesting here about the Pacers is another number, 92%. That is the retained minutes from last year. 92% is the second most in continuity. Behind the Boston Celtics, who went and won a championship last year. They got run into the ground this year. Jason Tatum tears his Achilles, and then we find out that Jaylen Brown needs to go under knee surgery, and he's going to be out for a while too. So, and Jrue Holiday wasn't totally right, and Kristaps Porzingis was dealing with that mysterious illness that, to this day, we don't really know exactly what happened there, but Indiana Pacers were like, we got our guys from last year. We're not even going to upgrade at the deadline. The only deadline move that they made, Dan, was they did a salary dump with James Wiseman. They were just like, let's get move off of that money. Unfortunately, he had his Achilles tear. But there wasn't this like huge deal at the deadline. Like they didn't trade for De'Aaron Fox or something similar, or Tyrese Halliburton for Domantas Sabonis, what have you. There wasn't this like major swing deal at the deadline that would make people believe that this is something sustainable or that this team is a title contender. And it took me a while. It took me a while to like put them on the contender list, the title tiers, because I was just like, I mean, do they have that like top 10 player, that top five player that can get them into the NBA finals and then put them over the hump? And it's like, you know what? Maybe we don't have that top five MVP candidate or a top 10 player right now, but we've got 1 through 8, a bunch of dogs. And I thought that OKC had a bunch of dogs, but man, this team, Indiana, 1 through 8, they are nasty, dude.
Just one quick point to your, because this is something that Tyrese Halliburton has said multiple times in multiple pressers. I just went back and found that it was after game one against New York when he hits the buzzer beating game tying shot to send it to overtime. He goes out of his way to praise the front office for not changing up that core. Quote, I think in the NBA, you don't see a ton of continuity from year to year, right? You know, many teams are changing from year to year. I think our front office did a great job of keeping this group together. And I think that this just gives us all confidence in each other. Like, we feel like we know where everyone's going to be. We have high expectations for each other, but we hold each other accountable at the same time. So their ability to go through their shortcomings last year, getting swept out of the Eastern Conference Finals by Boston, bring everybody back, add a healthy Mathurin back into the mix after he missed all last season with, I think it was just a torn labrum in his shoulder, and he rehabbed. He comes back this year, big part of their team. They feel like they understand each other better, and there certainly seems like that's paying dividends now in the big run that they've been on. The other part of keeping that continuity together, keeping that depth together, it goes into our second little number, 4.52. That is the average speed in miles per hour at which the Indiana Pacers have moved throughout this NBA Finals, according to the Second Spectrum tracking data. 4.52 miles per hour is faster on average than any team has moved in the finals in the tracking data era, which goes back to 2013-14, the Spurs Heat finals. On offense, they're a little faster on offense than on defense. Offense, it's 4.76 miles an hour. The only teams that have moved quicker, it makes a lot of sense when you think about it. Beautiful game, Spurs, the 2014-15 Warriors, that first Steph, Clay, Draymond team, the way that they sprinted, the way they moved the ball, the way they moved bodies, that makes a ton of sense. On defense, though, and this is, I think we've talked about it a little bit with the Pacers, 4.27 miles per hour, no finalist in that since 2013 has moved that fast. You combine that with their distance covered per game, just under 20 miles a game, which is 2 to 3 miles more than any other team in this sample. So this is what the style is. This is how, like, a lot of times those distance and speed numbers can kind of, like, they feel a little bit wonky. You don't know exactly what they're pointing to. With Indiana, this is their style laid out in numbers. It's the way they push the pace, the way they hunt early offense in transition. They force you to guard multiple actions throughout the course of a possession. The way that they pull it on full court pressure all the time. The way they have, like, these bad out of hell rotations on defense, the way that Aaron Nesmith and Andrew Nembhard and Ben Shepherd, Pascal Siakam, Obi Toppin even flying all over the place. Like, everybody's flying all over the place all the time. It weaponizes the entire dimensions of the court. It's the whole width of it, the whole length of it, the whole 24 seconds. And it that the aggregating total of that really wears on teams. And I think, I mean, you get to the fourth quarter in game three, Shea looks exhausted. They are getting beat down the floor. The guys are tugging on their shorts. It happened to the Knicks. It happened to the Cavs. It happened to the Bucks. It's happening again. I think we're seeing the speed and the distance kind of come home to roost yet again.
Crazy. Who would have thought that OKC after their long layoff would look like the gas team here, right? Like, it's crazy to think about that. And I'm glad you brought up the speed thing, because Andrew Nembhard came up a lot in my Blazers TV stuff that I was doing this season, because Tomadi Kamara was the league leader in defensive miles per hour. Like, Tomadi Kamara,
that makes a ton
out there
of sense.
Was at 4.49 miles per hour. And I did this, like, query, this filter on NBA.com stats, where I was like, all right, among 30 minutes per game guys, 30 minutes per game, he's number one in the NBA. But Andrew Nembhard was, like, right there at, like, 29.7 miles minutes per game. And he was right there in the defensive miles per hour. And I remember just how they were jockeying back and forth all season long. And I was trying to wrap my head around it, Dan. Like, why, if you're picking up full court, why would you be having more miles per hour or more distance covered? And the way I figured out is, like, normally when wing defenders are at the three-point line or on the perimeter and there's a rebound, going back on defense, you're only having to cover, like, three-quarters of the court.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're Nembhard or Nesmith or Tomadi Kamara, you're going the full 94 to go pick up Shai Gilgeous-Alexander out of the ball. Like, that inbounds pass, you're trying to intercept it McConnell style or Nembhard. And so that distance where they're going to the 94 feet and then following you back on defense, that little, like, quarter court where you're going to chase that inbounds pass and pressure full court, that adds up. And secondly, if you're not switching and you're fighting over screens,
yep,
you're going to add up more of that mileage and distance covered. And the way I like to think about it is, like, the math works out that 4.5 miles per hour is equivalent to roughly 400 feet per minute. James Harden, when he's on defense, he averages 3.27 miles per hour. That is the equivalent of about 300 feet per minute. So the difference between Tomadi Kamara and Andrew Nembhard and James Harden, the slowest quote-unquote guy, is 100 feet per minute onto the floor.
Wow.
Every minute they're on the floor. So it's, when you think about it, the fact that these guys are traveling, covering 100 feet per minute more than some of the other guys on the floor defensively, there are only a few players in the NBA that are built like that, that have that kind of drive, and a bunch of them are on these two teams in the NBA Finals. This is so much fun to watch these two teams going at it, because in many ways they're like mirrors. They're Spider-Man Meave looking at each other, because on the other side, you can argue Alex Caruso, Cason Wallace, and Lu Dort are built the same way, and yet the Pacers are doing it better than OKC right now.
They absolutely are. And I think part of the distance too, we'll get to the third little number here, 329.3. That's how many passes per game the Pacers are throwing in the NBA Finals. We've talked about the Pacers passing numbers before on this show. 329.3 is actually a little bit below Indiana's regular season number, where they were second in the league right behind Golden State. But crucially, it is more than 40 passes per game more than any team Oklahoma City had seen to this point. All three rounds in the Western Conference final, or Western Conference, the opponents were like 280 and below. And the Pacers are way up at 329.3. It's an indication, again, we talked about Carlisle calling their offense like an ecosystem, not so much a system, but an ecosystem, an environment in which spacing, pace, shooting, what kind of decisions you can force the opponent to make will dictate where the ball goes. And that sharing fosters an elite offense. And Mark Daigneault has said something that honestly, I'm still not totally sure I understand, but I also don't totally want to be an oppressor and ask him, hey, what do you mean by this? He has said multiple times during the series that the Pacers are, quote, a conceptual offense. And before game three, he said, if you go out there and you're like, hey, we're trying to stop this one player, then they're going to get you somewhere else. So that's the whack-a-mole thing, right? You over-index in one spot, something else pops up. So I think that's what he means by conceptual. It took me a little while to understand it because I'm slow. I'm not moving at 4.52 miles per hour on this podcast. But where that goes back to the passing, as incredible as OKC's defense is, individually and team, their help on the ball, off the ball, all of it, they're holding Indiana down, right? It's only been like 112 offensive rating for Indiana, which would be like bottom 10 offense during the regular season. The fact that the ball, they're getting beat by the pass, that they have not been able to hold down the movement, the ball movement. And when you've got that spacing, when you've got the speed at which things move, and when you've got the ball pinging around all over the place, even a defense this good, still, you know, like old coaches always say, like, you know, the ball is going to move faster than the man, right? Like,
yep.
Then I think that's what you're seeing. And then like that puts you in a position where you have to just cover so much to deal with them. And eventually you're going to blink, you're going to freeze, you're going to stall out, or you're just going to guess wrong. And the second you do that, somebody's popping an open three.
I mean, it's amazing to watch. Them on defense is great, but offensively, the fact that they're able to complete these passes, and some of these are, you know, Halliburton, some of these, and Nembhard, some of these passes are cross court. Like, it's a minefield trying to pass cross court and swing the ball against the Oklahoma City Thunder. Teams haven't survived this, and yet the Pacers are thriving in it. You mentioned historically how this compares. Like, I looked up the past six NBA champions and how many passes per game they've had. None of them are more than 290.
Yeah. They are
an
outlier.
330. It's crazy. It's crazy. And you would think that this would be problems. This would be problematic against an OKC team that has just all of these, long arms and the closeouts and the speed, that this would be an absolute Achilles heel for them. But they've been awesome. They've been awesome passing. What's the last one here?
Our last little number this week is 114.0. That is the Pacers' defensive rating against the Oklahoma City Thunder through three games. So that means that they've allowed the Thunder to score 114 points per 100 offensive possessions in this series. OKC during the regular season was up over 121. And every team that the Thunder have played so far has allowed them to score at least 116. The Pacers are the best, have performed the best defensively of any team against Oklahoma City in the playoffs. And I think this is probably the thing that is most often overlooked about the Pacers as they exist right now. They're a good defense. I think, again, going back to that idea of a first impression or of a confirmation bias, anchoring bias, people remember last year's team. They remember the team that went to the NBA Cup or the in-season tournament final. And they're like, well, they scored a bunch, but they didn't defend anybody. And that has not been the book on this team for 6 months now. What Aaron Nesmith, what Andrew Nembhard, TJ McConnell, Ben Shepherd, Benedict Mathurin, all of these guys are picking up full court. Pascal Siakam and Obi Toppin, length, athleticism, speed, foot speed, guarding up front, able to like cross match off a non-shooter or like sag off Lou Dortin, muck up things as a help defender. Miles Turner as a rim protector, Thomas Bryant as an auxiliary rim protector when he gets in the game. You go now, and even Tyrese Halliburton, he's viewed as the weak link, and I understand that, but he's big, he's got long arms, he's got a really good sense of when to gamble, get his hands in the passing lane, deflect. He's become an event-creating defensive player with, you know, steals, deflections, block shots on opportunistic help. He knows when to go for it, and he knows how to get himself out of trouble with the way they communicate and get out of like pre-switching out of bad matchups. Some of this is that continuity we talked about. Some of that is just the personnel being better. Some of it is Rick Carlisle and his coaching staff being able to find ways to get the most out of this talent. But we have seen this team go from a bad defense to a legitimate top 10 defense to shutting down or really making life difficult on one of the best teams we've ever seen in the space of 18 months. And I think that like that is the part that gets less credit, less credence, and less understanding. Maybe because it's a little bit harder to understand what how teams improve on defense. But whether you understand it or not, or are aware of it or not, the Pacers are making you aware of it now. But get this is why they're too like they're not scoring the lights out. They're not shooting the lights out in this series. They are grinding out the Thunder defensively, and that's got them up 2-1.
First play of the game, game three, off the rip. Nembhard is just in Shai Gilgeous-Alexander's jersey and just pissing him off. Just he's not happy. And he gives him that forearm, which I'm surprised that the refs didn't call a flagrant on it. And that set the tone for the entire game. And they played like it was a game seven. Dude, like their intensity was game seven-esque. And it was from start to finish. And OKC just ran out of gas. And I am so impressed by how hard this team continues to play. You thought the Knicks played hard. You thought OKC played hard. The Pacers are playing much harder than those teams. They are. And that's that continuity. That's Rick Carlisle. That is the entire team banding together in the second half of the season with Nesmith. When he got inserted into the starting lineup and Mathurin went to the bench, like the defense, they got their identity and they figured out how they're going to operate on both ends of the floor. And there's the trust that you have to have that Nembhard is going to just be cloaking Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And they're okay with that because everybody's going to be helping you to recover and be able to have you in case SGA gets past you. It's just, it's amazing to watch how hard they play, how smart they play. And defensively, like you pointed out, they're doing a way better job, I think, than people are giving him credit for. So that's the Pacers. We've got other news in the NBA that we got to hit, including Kevin Durant, according to ESPN's Shams Charania. He's got a little list with Rich Kleiman, his manager, a little bit of a list of preferred destinations. We're going to get into that and more right after the break. All right, Dan, on Wednesday, we got a report from Shams Charania over at ESPN that the Phoenix Suns and Kevin Durant's business partner, boardroom CEO Rich Kleiman, have met multiple times over the past week and are sifting through trade scenarios. And the two sides are expected to work together on potential destinations. Teams have expressed interest in KD, sources said, mainly featuring the Houston Rockets, San Antonio Spurs, the Miami Heat, Minnesota Timberwolves, and the New York Knicks. Some wild cards that they said also in the mix, ESPN reporting. Those teams make sense. You got Houston, a team that has basically Phoenix's entire pick catalog, and they needed a veteran guy to improve their half-court offense, and what better player to do that than KD to replace Jalen Green. You got San Antonio, where there's a lot of rumors about him having interest to play with Wemby in San Antonio, a guy who went to UT Austin and feeling like this might be a good way to finish out your career, or at least the chapter that you would want to experience. The Miami Heat, of course, always star chasing. Pat Riley putting rings onto the table and saying, I want you, KD. I got LeBron. I got Jimmy Butler. And now, KD, come on down. Minnesota, obviously the Anthony Edwards connection from last year at last summer at Team USA. And the Knicks, always star hunting. Of course, Leon Rose, and now without Tom Thibodeau, they're going to want to shake things up even more. And I could understand why they would want to go after KD. I'm also watching this finals, Dan. If Indiana pulls this off, I'm going to go there.
Let's hear
it. Does OKC, after watching how the Indiana Pacers showed a lot more experience and a lot more moxie defensively, that the offense, as we talked about, has kind of gotten mucked down and not being able to score at a high rate when you have some of these dogs on the other side. What if OKC decides, let's bring back KD? What if they say, we've got all these picks, Phoenix, I know you're going to want your picks back. You have the cupboard is bare. If KD was on the table and the two big lineup, you've already kind of abandoned that a little bit and you're not thrilled about it. Do you put Isaiah Hartenstein as kind of the face of this deal? You got Aaron Wiggins' contract, you got Isaiah Joe's contract, and you throw in a bunch of picks to satisfy the Phoenix Suns that have zero picks going forward. And you say, here's your big. Here's your passing big to help facilitate next to Devin Booker and Bradley Beal and the rest of your roster. And we bring KD home and have that veteran leadership, the champion, and what a story that would be. And oh, by the way, we're still going to have Chet. We're still going to have J-Dub. We're going to have Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, but we're going to slot in Kevin freaking Durant in a homecoming. I don't know if Sam Presti would do that. It would take, I think, an embarrassing five-game loss, the opposite of Jay-Z's bet. If the Pacers win the next two games, I think everything's on the table for the Oklahoma City Thunder, including maybe a reunion with Kevin Durant. How crazy is that? Do you think that is bonkers to see maybe Kevin Durant and OKC reunion?
I think it's a little crazy. I think partially it's a little crazy because of just I don't know that the vibes were super great after he left. And I mean, I know it's been a long time, but I also don't know that all parties involved are like moved on completely from that emotionally. You know, it doesn't seem like that was like a pretty heavy breakup. I don't know that you're going to go back and revisit that in a decade. But the other part of it. And so like when you said, I'm watching this finals, where I thought you were going to go is if you are a team that wants to compete like this, with this kind of where what we're seeing, the blueprint of what's going forward is depth and athleticism and youth and speed and everything else, is the finals now no country for old men? Have we arrived at a place where Kevin Durant, 17 years in, 48,000 minutes in, off, you know, several years removed from an Achilles rupture, going to be 37 years old when the season starts. Do you not really want to throw a whole lot on the table for Kevin Durant? Like, if I'm Oklahoma City, am I saying, how confident am I? If I'm not confident that all of my guys that I have now, all my young guys that are on the upswing are surviving a series like this, how confident am I that he is and that he's going to get to the end of it and be, you know, an all NBA caliber performer by the end of it? I don't know the answer to that. And am I going to want to trade what it costs to get him and then whatever a presumed extension would be to find out when windows close immediately today? I'm not so sure about that. I think it's an interesting thought experiment. If I was Oklahoma City, I would be a little bit reticent to make that dramatic a change. But
it would only take like a five-game loss to the Indiana Pacers, I think, for them to even consider such a move. Because if you lose in seven, do you make such a drastic change there? I do think that if they lose this NBA Finals, there will be some sort of change with Isaiah Hartenstein's contract. It would make sense to try to get someone that would help them improve that offense, or at least provide a little bit more of that veteran stability. It's not like James Johnson is helping the Indiana Pacers on the floor, like tremendously, right? But like Pascal Siakam has won a title. And I do feel like, you know, Alex Caruso, is he that figure? Maybe. But if things go sideways here for OKC, I wouldn't rule it out. I don't think it's going to happen. I think it's more likely we see Houston. I think it's more like we see Minnesota. But I just think, you know, even OKC, like as a 1 year rental, even do you need to extend him? Kawhi Leonard, when he went to Toronto, it was just like a gamble. And right. You never knew if Kawhi Leonard was going to be able to, you know, if he was not happy with that situation in Toronto. All the same sort of questions were there with Kawhi when Masai Ujiri and the Toronto Raptors made that deal for Kawhi Leonard. It was a similar situation, albeit, of course, KD's 37, going to be 37. It's a little bit different. But that was too tantalizing for me not to bring up on this show. Is there a matchup or a marriage for Kevin Durant here in this offseason where he's going to be able to pick up maybe an extra 2 years or another year in his extension with his new team? Do you see another landing spot for Kevin Durant this summer that isn't already listed, or do you like one particular team?
Yeah, I feel like the most realistic ones of the groups that have been mentioned are, you know, you mentioned Houston, something built around Jalen Green or Dylan Brooks, and that as like your big matching salary with take your pick of the young guys around it, pick or two, whatever. Or probably the ant drawing him in Minnesota. That feels like a realistic possibility. And it's something in my brain likes the rhyming of KG to KD. Like I kind of enjoy that as a way to make things connect. But if you're talking about like, what's the, like, give me a young up and coming team that really could use that kind of weapon. Houston's one of them. I don't know that KD would go there, but let me see KD to the Detroit Pistons. Let me see like a Tobias Harris, beef stew, take your pick, a Ron Hollander, Jaden Ivey. We'll discuss some draft pick compensation, but like give Cade Cunningham a target to pass to. Give somebody like the balance and the benefit of we have guys who can shoot and space the floor for Cade Cunningham, and that leads all of a sudden he's an all-NBA point guard. I wonder if that would look even more potent with Kevin Durant there on the wing. But I don't know how realistic any of that is. I don't know if Detroit's looking to like immediately hit the gas after first just making the playoffs last year, their big turnaround. I don't know if KD would be psyched about going there. I think there's a lot still uncertain about this whole dynamic, but I want that. One of my favorite types of things that happens in the NBA right now is Chris Paul on his like basketball Johnny Appleseed or like Kane and Kung Fu journey of like, I bring the gospel of beautiful basketball wherever I go for 1 year at a time. And I like invest in the young players and help them grow. And it's like my year in OKC with SGA, my years in Oklahoma City with, or my year in San Antonio with Wemby, like just going around and bringing good basketball wherever he goes. Let's see KD do that. Let's see him reinvest, you know, in the Motor City. Let's say that.
I like that. I think it's a really big question for some of these young teams. Do you look at what Indiana and OKC did this year and just say, let's just stay the course. Let's just bring the band back together and go forward. And Indiana, if they win this, I think it's going to be a big lesson for a lot of these teams, these young cores like Detroit, to see if like, should we go get a KD? And for OKC, like it's a different math. It's a different question, a different calculus for them, whether they bring in a talent like that. And I think people need to remember that for Phoenix, if they don't get their picks, they have no incentive to tank.
Yeah.
So they're going to want a Rudy Gobert coming the other way. They're going to want an Isaiah Stewart coming the other way. They're going to want an Isaiah Hartenstein to come the other way and anchor their defense. And so these ideas of like, why would Phoenix ever want Rudy Gobert? Well, it's because they don't have any reason to tank. Right. And they want a really good defender. Well, it's hard to beat Hartenstein. It's hard to beat Beef Stew. It's hard to beat Rudy Gobert in order to anchor and upgrade from Yusuf Nurkic. And so that's why you would think maybe they add one of these bigs that can do so much in improving the defensive side of the floor. I think he's going to either Houston or San Antonio, but I love this idea of Detroit. And if Indiana pulls this off in gentleman sweep fashion, I don't think it's a true gentleman sweep, but I would say
nothing gentlemanly about what these dudes are doing right now, man. This has been brutal.
It has been brutal. So, I think if it ends quickly here, OKC gets the offseason gets really interesting, especially with Chet Holmgren and J-Dubs extensions kicking in down the horizon. Do you have this little window here to add some payroll on a 1 or 2 year deal a la Jimmy Butler? It's it gets a little interesting. Man, that would be fun. I'm not saying we get Russell Westbrook back and KD back and OKC for that last hurrah. I'm just saying that would be an incredible story. And already a bonkers NBA offseason ahead of us. I feel like that would be amazing if KD went back to OKC. But who knows? Who knows? What I do know is, Jay-Z, if you need some writers into the room, do not call us.
Yeah. Look, you mustn't be afraid to dream a little bit bigger, darling. Like, come on. Yeah. You know, I'm sure you can afford better writers than us. But
you know what? You know what? I was listening to you talk about, like, it's not a system, it's an ecosystem.
Man.
I thought about the Jay-Z line.
Of course you did. Yeah. I mean, it's where our heads are at, but we got to get our heads out of here and then the rest of us have to follow.
That's going to do it for us today. Thank you for sticking with us. That was great. Thank you so much to Emmy and Mike and the entire squad that works behind the scenes to make this dream a reality. Please watch The Big Number on YouTube. Subscribe. Tell your friends. Also subscribe. 5-star review. Rate and review wherever you listen to this on your podcast app, whatever. Wherever you get this, just please support us. Leave us a rating and review. Please. We'll be back next week. Hang tight for another Big Number next week. I don't know where this series is going to go, but things could get really spicy for next week. I'm excited. Until then, listen to some Jay-Z. Yeah. Peace.